standing on top of the truck, handing pieces of the barricade down to other workers who were carrying them and setting them up.
"We're here to help. What do you need?"
The city worker looked at them, saw the size of John, and said, "You bet. I'll set each piece here, then one of you hands it on to whoever comes to collect it. The other carry pieces to whoever is installing the barrier." They went to work. Nathaniel stood at the truck, receiving pieces of the fencing material, and John carried, because it burned a little of his nervous energy and gave him a chance to keep his eye on the truck. That scene hadn't changed. The truck sat as an oasis of quiet amid the chaos around it. When they were waiting for the next person to come to the truck, Nathaniel turned to the worker and said, "Have they tried evacuating the school?" The worker shook his head.
"No go. That guy sitting there said that if one person pops their head out of that building, he'll set the bomb off and take everyone with him."
"Has he said what he wants?"
"To talk to the governor. He said he's not budging until the governor gets here."
"That could take a while."
"If you ask me, the governor's not going to want to come near this mess."
"Probably right. If he puts in an appearance and the whole place goes up, that's not good for a political career. But meanwhile, there are a few dozen teachers in there, trying to keep hundreds of kids calm." An hour later, the barricade was complete, and the truck was completely surrounded, with several hundred yards of space between it and the thousands of worried parents and spectators who had lined up on the perimeter. John had found Melissa, and they stood at the far left-hand edge of the perimeter fence, never taking their eyes off the truck or the windows of the school. Melissa had brought John his binoculars, and he kept them trained on the window of what they knew to be Kate's classroom, but there were no faces to be seen there. 2 hours after they had arrived, much had changed. With the barriers erected, no one was milling around the area of the potential blast radius. Reinforcements for the local police had arrived in the form of the Oregon State Patrol, and a police officer stood just inside the barrier every 20 to 30 feet, his or her back to the bomb, watching the crowd. News stations from Portland had arrived and were setting up their satellite trucks. As with so many of these kind of events, the first images came from people uploading videos from their phones to Twitter, Facebook, Imgur, Instagram, and half a dozen other social media sites. Across America and around the world, millions of eyes were on the same thing. A panel truck with a small, nervous man sitting on the bumper, watching the crowd carefully. The final addition was a sleek black helicopter that hovered just at the edge of the blast area. The man on the truck watched the chopper for a minute, then picked up his bullhorn and said,
"You've got 1 minute to move that bird the hell away from me, or the whole place goes up."
It took less than 30 seconds for the helicopter to retreat and disappear over the horizon. The man used the bullhorn to say, "Thank you," then sat it down on the back bumper. He reached behind him and retrieved what looked like a brown flask. With his left hand, he loosened the cap, took a deep swig, then replaced the cap and put it back behind him. His right hand held tight to the small plastic device. John watched the man's every move through his binoculars.
"Look at his damn hand. It's shaking like hell. My daughter's life depends on some maniac not dropping that switch, and it looks like he's got the DTs."
He turned to Nathaniel.
"Okay. I listened to you. We moved back. We built the barrier. We waited for someone else to do something, but no one is doing anything other than making him famous. So, what's your plan?"
Chapter 26. "This is it, then, the point I've been waiting for and dreading. The moment of decision is upon me, and it's easy to see now. There really is no decision to make." Nathaniel looked John in the eye. He smiled, but it was just a quick flash.
"I'll take care of it, John. But I'll need some help from you."
"You know I'll do anything."
"Let's step back from the barrier a little."
John, Melissa, and Nathaniel turned and walked away, and their spots were immediately filled by people who had been standing behind them. "Look," Nathaniel said, pointing to a spot a few yards away. "Their gaps aren't quite right. That officer has too much ground to cover, and he's standing right where there's a little room between the fencing. I need you to slip through there, and when he tries to stop you, run parallel to the barrier. Don't move toward the truck, and don't let him stop you. Run toward the cop that's down there and make them tackle you, okay?" John eyeballed the somewhat paunchy police officer closest to them.
"Yeah, of course, no problem. But what good does that do us?"
"You just do that, and I'll do the rest. I hope." Nathaniel glanced at the truck, then at the school. "Listen, John, if this doesn't go right, I'm sorry. I think I can handle this, but there is no way to be sure. I've done my best to see what's coming, and I don't think it's going to end well any other way. So if I foul it all up and I'm blown into 1,000 tiny bits, tell Mom I love her, and I appreciate everything she did for me. And if that happens, will you take care of Brutus? He's going to live a long, long time." John cocked his head.
"Brother, I have no idea what you're thinking about, but you know I trust you with my whole being. Godspeed."
John and Nathaniel pushed forward toward the small gap in the barrier. John had to push a few people aside to get there, and cries of, "Hey," and "Knock it off," were thrown at their backs. A moment later, they were at the barricade, and John didn't hesitate. He turned sideways and slipped through. The officer took a step toward him, but John took off at a run. Instinctively, the cop chased after him. Nathaniel took advantage of the gap to slip through the fence and walked toward the truck. All eyes were on the hubbub John had caused, so he was 20 yards past the barrier before anyone noticed him. Nathaniel wasn't running, but he was walking at a steady clip.
"Hey, somebody stop that guy!"
One of the cops wrestling with John shouted, but no one was near enough to easily intercept him. By the time the officer farther down the barrier noticed him, Nathaniel was already past the point of no return. The area all personnel had been ordered not to cross. They gathered in his wake and shouted to him, telling him to return immediately. But Nathaniel walked on as though he were stone deaf. He crossed the street in front of the school, and the man sitting on the back of the truck noticed him for the first time. He stood on the bumper, peering at the approaching figure. Nathaniel didn't start to run, neither did he slow down. He walked as though he was right on time for an appointment he had made long ago. The man on the truck hopped down, picked up the bullhorn, and said, "Hey, asshole! You trying to get yourself and everyone else killed?" Nathaniel lifted a hand in greeting, but continued forward. Behind him, every television camera, every cell phone, focused in on him. Soon, Nathaniel was close enough to him that he could read the design on the man's t-shirt. It read, "Sic Semper Tyrannis." The same thing John Wilkes Booth shouted after assassinating President Lincoln. I'm tempted to ask him if he's a big fan of assassinations, but I don't think I'd like the answer. So I'll play it straight. Too much at stake. Nathaniel looked the man over. Smallish, a week's worth of stubble, eyes twitching left and right. Nervous. That makes sense. I need to find a way to talk to him, to reach him. When Nathaniel was 10 feet away, the man put the bullhorn down and spoke in a normal tone of voice. "Are you deaf or just stupid?" Nathaniel paused, stretched his back a little, and sat down on the grass, cross-legged. The man's mouth fell open. "Oh, my sweet jumping Jesus. You must have escaped from the loony bin. How did they let you slip through? Just my goddamn luck." "Hey, I'm Nathaniel. I'm not here to bullshit you. I'm not here to get you to change your mind about anything, but while it's just the two of us talking, how about if we agree to not bullshit each other? Let's just be honest. I mean, I'm just one man, unarmed, and I mean you no harm. What do you say? What's your name?" The man reached behind him, where he had kept the flask. "My name is your worst nightmare, you son of a bitch." He pulled out a revolver and pointed it at Nathaniel's chest. Chapter 27. On the rooftop of a building a block behind the barricade, a SWAT sniper chinned on his microphone.
"This is Blue One. I've got the shot. Over."
"On which one?" the SWAT commander on the other end wondered. Into his own microphone, he said.
"Do not take the shot. I repeat, do not take the shot. We have confirmed he is holding a dead man switch. Over."
"Or if it's not a dead man switch, it looks enough like one to fool us," he said to the man standing beside him.
"Roger," Blue One answered, and continued to watch the action unfold through his scope.
Down on the field, Nathaniel opened his arms slightly, palms turned upward.
"You can absolutely shoot and kill me if you want. That doesn't gain you much of anything, though, does it? It doesn't make you or your cause look any better.
It would make it nice and quiet again, like it was before you got here."
Nathaniel laughed.
"True."
The man himself laughed a little.
"Oh, shit, son. Why don't you get out of here so I don't have to shoot you? I'd recommend you turn around right now and get back behind that fence line they've got set up along there. There's going to be some fireworks here real soon."
"I just can't do that. Too many innocent people inside that building. And one of them is my goddaughter, who I have sworn on my life to protect no matter the cost. My guess is you want to make a big statement about something, and you're willing to die for it. That's why you drove the truck up here hours ago, and now you've waited this long so the media would have time to set up and make you famous."
"I take it back. You're not so stupid after all."
Nathaniel nodded, then looked to the west. The sun had dipped below the horizon, and he watched the final faint glow of the day fade away. He thought briefly of his small house, the peace and quiet, the friendships he had enjoyed there. Finally, he stared straight up into the sudden twilight, looking for an answer he could not find.
"Too late to look for God, boy."
"Never too late for that."
Nathaniel drew a deep breath.
"Okay, then."
Nathaniel stood up and dusted the grass off his jeans. "Nothing else for it, then." He took three strides toward the man on the truck, whose eyes grew wide. He scrambled up and stood on the bumper, then stepped up onto the bed of the truck so he could look down on Nathaniel. He pointed the gun at Nathaniel's chest and pulled the trigger. The bullet struck him just below the breastbone and staggered him back a few steps. Nathaniel closed his eyes, and the hole healed itself.
"Holy shit, what kind of cyborg mutant alien shit is that?"
Nathaniel took three more steps toward the man. The man on the truck, realizing the gun was no good, dropped it behind him.
"You're making me nervous, boy."
He held out the switch in his right hand and shook it threateningly.
"It's not me making you nervous. You're nervous because you know you're lost and still hoping to be found. But it's almost too late, at least for this life."
The man glared at Nathaniel.
"Fuck you, smart guy."
He reached his right hand out toward Nathaniel and dropped the switch. Chapter 28. For a frozen moment, all remained quiet. So quiet, in fact, that Nathaniel heard the switch nestle into the soft green grass. As it did, the dual fuse igniter set off hundreds of pounds of Tovex Blast Right gel, which in turn erupted a dozen barrels of ammonium nitrate and nitromethane. Hell came to Earth. The blast eradicated the truck and the man standing in it. They were both simply gone. The heat, the pure destructive power of the explosion, turned man, truck, and contents into minute bits of detritus. Nathaniel stood, only a few feet away, head bowed, arms extended toward the blast. He was not eradicated. He lifted his face into the force of the blast and accepted it, sought it out. He pulled everything, every bit of it, into himself. The heat, the energy, the hundreds of pounds of nails packed into the truck to inflict maximum damage, all poured into Nathaniel, but did not destroy him. Moments after the blast erupted, it was gone. The truck, the man, everything was simply gone. Where it had once been, a single man stood, unwavering. Nathaniel once again lifted his face to the darkening sky and elevated his fists. When his hands were at their apex, he straightened his fingers out and a blast of pure white light poured into the sky. It continued for what felt like an eternity. The thousands who had gathered could only watch, squinting and shielding their eyes from the brightness. The entire area had become brighter than noon on a clear summer day. When the light faded away, twilight returned. Almost instantly, frogs and crickets began to sing. Nathaniel turned and looked for John. "You can go get Katie now, brother. She's safe." Uniformed cops and men in dark suits ran toward him in a full sprint. Nathaniel stood and waited for them. A moment later, he was surrounded. The men were agitated, fighting over who was in charge, whether it was a federal or local crime scene, and finally whether it was a crime scene at all. These were men who were used to following a straight-line narrative through life, and everything they thought they knew had just gone up in a beam of light. They were also mindful that they had just seen a man, a single, unimpressive man, do what they all knew was impossible. If he could do that, what else was he capable of? Through the argument, Nathaniel stood patiently. He had no idea what was coming, but he knew that life as he had known it was over. Chapter 29. Finally, an older man in a black suit, white shirt, and red tie approached the group. He still had a full head of hair, but it was pure white. The men at the fringes of the small crowd moved aside to let him pass. The man approached Nathaniel, cocked his head at him with a squint, and said, "I'm Special Agent Tim Johnson, FBI, Portland Field Office." Nathaniel nodded but didn't speak. "Can you tell me what just happened here? Because I saw it with my own eyes, and I still don't have any idea."
"Sure, I can tell you. I tried to talk to him, but it was no use. He was absolutely intent on blowing up the school and doing as much damage as he could. Once I saw I couldn't stop him, I baited him into detonating the bomb. I was worried that he might shoot me before he did that, and if he did, I wouldn't have been able to absorb the blast."
"Absorb the blast?"
"Yes. I sought out all the energy of the bomb, all the damage it was going to do, then pulled it inside myself. I converted it to energy and released it in a way that wouldn't harm anyone."
"The damnedest thing is that's exactly what I saw with my own eyes, but I still can't accept that. Until we get this straightened out, we're going to keep you with us as our guest."
Johnson looked around at the uniformed officers.
"I don't want to take him back to Portland right now. Mind if we use your station until I figure out what I'm going to do with him?"
A Middle Falls police officer stepped forward and said,
"That'll be fine. I'll let the chief know to expect us."
Johnson looked at Nathaniel like he was a bug under a microscope.
"We'd like you to accompany us, and one way or another you're going to. You're not under arrest, but we are going to handcuff you for everyone's safety on the way to the station."
Behind Johnson, an officer murmured,
"Like a pair of cuffs is going to hold a guy who just did that."
Nathaniel shrugged and put his hands behind his back. Another man in a dark suit stepped forward and put the cuffs on him. The rest of the crowd was still being held behind the barricades, but John had managed to break through again and ran up to the crowd of law enforcement officers.
"Nathaniel, what the hell are they doing to you? You just saved everyone. Now they're putting you in cuffs?"
Nathaniel smiled, shrugged, and said,
"I guess I'm going downtown. Tell Mom I'm okay. There's nothing to worry about."
"I will. I'll get a lawyer and get him down there ASAP. Don't worry."
Will someone get this guy out of here? What kind of crowd control do you have going on?
Two police officers grabbed John by the arm, but couldn't move him.
Nathaniel, John said, and tears glistened in his eyes.
I'm sorry you had to do this, but thank you. For Katie, I'll never forget it.
A third policeman joined the other two and managed to drag John away. Before he was out of earshot, Nathaniel yelled,
Grab Brutus for me, will you?
John lifted an arm in acknowledgement. A Chevy Tahoe with darkened windows pulled up where the rental truck had just been a few minutes earlier. There was no sign of an explosion where it had been, just the tire tracks. Two more men in suits jumped out of it and held the back door open. Johnson touched Nathaniel on the shoulder lightly.
Here's our ride.
20 minutes later, Nathaniel sat at a table in a small room inside the Middle Falls police station. It wasn't nearly as big or fancy as similar rooms he had seen in movies. There was no wall with a big mirror on it that he would know was really a two-way window. Just a small table, two chairs, and a cup of coffee in a plastic cup. They had removed the cuffs, so he was unencumbered. Nathaniel took a small sip of the coffee and winced. Mental note, don't do that again. Nathaniel was left cooling his heels for an unknown time. Don't know if that is because they don't know what to do with me, or because they want to give me time to get nervous. Nathaniel straightened his spine, closed his eyes, and meditated. He was in the same position an hour later when Johnson came in, also carrying a cup of coffee. He sat down opposite Nathaniel, who opened his eyes and looked at him calmly. Johnson took a sip of coffee and winced.
Oh my God!
Nathaniel grinned.
See, common ground already. I thought about warning you, but figured you wouldn't believe me until you tasted it.
Johnson looked down at the cup in his hand.
How do you even do that to coffee?
He shook his head and pushed the cup away.
Look, Moon, I'm going to be completely upfront with you. We have no idea what we're dealing with here. None of us have ever seen anything like what happened, and we don't have a playbook for that. I thought we had a playbook for everything.
He opened a file folder and looked at the scant few sheets of paper. He held them up.
Typically, I have a lot more to go on than this. I can't even find a birth certificate for you. First record I have that you exist was when you started school at Middle Falls Elementary in 1984. You're almost invisible beyond your school and work records. No social media accounts, no cell phone, no anything. It looks like you didn't even have a debit card, let alone a credit card.
I like to live a quiet life. It's just me and my dog, Brutus. When my friends want to talk to me, they come see me. It's a good life.
Johnson looked a little wistful for just a moment. He turned over another sheet of paper.
Absolutely no police record. Not even a speeding ticket.
I don't speed.
You don't speed, Johnson said distractedly. Right, what do you do?
I'm a janitor at the hospital, but I'm sure you know that. I have a recording studio in my basement and I make music there. Based on the reaction of everyone who has listened before you, you probably wouldn't like it. I hike with my dog, I read, I tend to my garden and try to grow as much of my own food as I can.
Johnson wiped a hand across his face, then twisted his head left, then right.
What I need to know is, how were you able to do what you did today? Human beings can't stand a few feet away from a blast like that and live to tell about it. I've watched the film of it more than a dozen times, and from four different angles. I still have no idea how you did it, and I don't know if I should arrest you, hug you, or nominate you for the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
How did I do it? Doesn't matter. You saw it with your own eyes. A dozen cameras recorded it.
He put a finger through the bullet hole in the middle of his shirt, then lifted the shirt to show nothing but smooth skin underneath. Johnson closed the file folder, glared at Nathaniel.
Son, it's about to not be my problem anymore, because every damn television network in the world is playing that tape over and over in heavy rotation. CNN brought in a magician to explain how the optical illusion worked.
Fox News brought him the Right Reverend Billy Holstein to explain that it was God's miracle. I have a hunch that this whole incident is about to get blown up above my pay grade. That's why I wanted to talk to you now while I have the chance.
Johnson shook his head and grimaced. Without realizing it, he reached down and rubbed his lower back.
Your back bother you?
You a doctor?
Definitely not. What's wrong?
I don't think they have any idea. I heard it about 5 years back, climbing over a fence, apprehending a suspect who was a lot younger and a little faster than me. They've done 2 surgeries on it so far, but nothing has helped.
How often does it bother you?
Every damned minute of every damned day.
Listen, you asked me how I did what I did at the school. I can't explain it.
I can show you, if you want.
First, I've got to ask you a couple of questions.
Asking questions is my job.
Humor me, and I'll be able to show you some of the answers.
Johnson paused, then finally nodded and said,
I'm game.
How's your life? If I told you that what I was about to do would make you live a lot longer, would that be a good thing or a bad thing?
Live longer?
Johnson mused on that, letting it roll around in his mind.
More time to be out on the boat, enjoying retirement? Yeah, that's not a bad thing.
Are you married?
Just to the FBI.
Okay. I can fix your back for you if you want.
Call me a cynic, but sometimes I don't even believe what I see with my own eyes, because I've experienced enough to know I can be fooled.
I understand. You might believe what you actually feel, though. Hold out your hand like we're going to shake.
Hesitantly, Johnson did. Nathaniel grasped it gently. He closed his eyes for only a few seconds, then released him. Johnson jumped like he had been shocked. He pushed his chair back and jumped straight up. He stretched his back like he had just woken up from a long nap. Then he shook his head, dazed.
Nathaniel leaned back in his chair. I've been in chronic pain for 5 years. There's never a time that it's not hurting at least a little, and usually a lot. Except, right now, it doesn't. I can't even remember what it feels like to not hurt.
Johnson twisted at the waist, side to side, up and down. He bent over and touched his toes.
I'll be goddamned.
Good.
What did you do?
I fixed it.
Can you do that for anything?
Nathaniel shrugged his shoulders.
As far as I know.
Cancer?
Yes.
Holy shit, man!
Johnson glanced up at the video camera in the corner of the room. Red light steady, recording everything.
If you can do that, you've got to share it with the world.
Do I?
Nathaniel ran his fingers around the top of the cup of terrible coffee in front of him.
I help who I can, in the ways I think I can do the most good.
I have always known that if the world knew what I could do, any chance of just living my life would be gone.
Maybe now you understand why I live a quiet life. I've never wanted to attract attention, because I knew what would happen. I knew I would end up in a room like this. I knew that someone or something, some person, some organization, or some government agency, would want to take me apart to see what made me tick.
He glanced around at the industrial green walls and slightly wobbly table.
I always thought it would be a slightly nicer room than this, though.
Chapter 30. There was a knock on the only door that led into the interrogation room.
Yes,
Johnson said, annoyance obvious in his voice. A younger man also dressed in the de facto FBI uniform. Dark suit, white shirt, tie, poked his head in.
Sorry, but we've got something brewing out here. There's a man who says he is this man's attorney, and he says that if we don't let him in to talk to his client, he's going to hold a press conference out on the front steps of the courthouse, questioning why we are holding him. Oh, and there's about 100 reporters out there, and more arriving every minute.
Damn it. Any word from Washington yet?
Just that we're in a holding pattern. Keep him here. Try to keep a lid on it. I think they're flying someone out, but they won't be here for hours yet.
I didn't hear anything in there about suspending an individual's rights for the good of the nation. Mr. Moon, you have an attorney wishing to speak to you. Do you wish to speak to him?
I think I would. Yes.
Surely they've got a bigger conference room in this place than this, Johnson said to the junior agent.
The younger agent poked his head back out and had a muffled conversation with someone Nathaniel couldn't see. Yes, sir, they do.
Have someone fetch his attorney there, and someone to show us where the conference room is. Johnson stood, stretched, and said, Probably not much more I can do for you than that.
Understood. Thank you.
I'm likely to lose control of what's going on here. Some heavy hitter from Washington will be showing up soon, and I'll be shuffled back up to Portland. In case I don't see you again, I appreciate what you just did for me. I am a new man.
Nathaniel was left alone in a much bigger conference room, sitting at a long table with nearly a dozen chairs around it. Still no two-way mirror, though. Maybe Middle Falls just isn't big enough to spring for that kind of budget. A young Middle Falls officer opened the door and escorted in an older man carrying a briefcase. He was just a few pounds on the wrong side of the scale, but had an open, pleasant face and distinguished gray hair. He walked to Nathaniel, set the briefcase on the table, and offered his hand. Nathaniel? Nathaniel nodded and shook his hand. Interesting vibe. Not an ordinary man. Same thing I felt when I first met Andy and John, which means...
Pleased to meet you, the man said, interrupting Nathaniel's thoughts. I'm Thomas Weaver. I'm an attorney here in town. Your friend John West called me at home this evening and asked me to come down and possibly represent you. He thought you might need the kind of help I can provide.
I've seen your office downtown, right across from the library, right?
Exactly. Weaver took a yellow pad out of the briefcase and asked, Mind if I sit?
I appear to have dragged you away from hearth and home late on a Wednesday evening, so I think you're entitled to a chair.
Before we begin, John asked me to tell you that he's picked up your dog. He also believes you saved his daughter's life. Now, Weaver said, settling in, I'm going to ask you a few questions, but if you need to know something from me, stop me any time. To be clear, I don't represent you yet. I will make this first consultation pro bono. But I need to know if you would like me to represent you. If so, then anything you tell me in this room will be protected under attorney-client privilege.
That doesn't matter, Mr. Weaver.
Please, call me Thomas.
Sure, Thomas. In any case, privilege doesn't matter here. I've got nothing to hide. I did nothing wrong. I just did something unusual, and now the government is involved. That's never good. But at the same time, it would be good to have someone who understands the law advising me. So, yes, I would like to hire you to represent me. Do you require a retainer?
No, none needed. Let's see where this is headed first. Okay,
he said absently, putting pen to pad.
Have they told you if you are being charged with anything?
No, I'm not sure what they would charge me with. Hindering a domestic terrorist in the commission of a felony?
Yes, right, I've seen the footage. I think most people in America have seen the footage by now. Remarkable.
One concern is that they might paint this whole thing as a hoax, whether it was or not.
An illusion, like when the magician made the Statue of Liberty disappear. Governments don't like things they can't explain or control.
Just for reference, I couldn't do that. Make Lady Liberty disappear, I mean. Look, I know this all has to seem pretty odd, coming into it cold.
Don't worry, I've seen some odd things in my lifetime. I know there are things that have no easy or obvious explanation, but are true, nonetheless. We'll proceed from there. So, they can hold you for 24 hours without charging you, or if the feds get involved, which is likely, up to 14 days, if they invoke the Terrorism Act.
Mr. Weaver, what you saw on the tape is exactly what happened. If, for the sake of argument, we can agree that's true, What would you advise me to do?
Well, we have options. We can cooperate fully. Essentially, let them do with you what they will while they investigate. But I don't think that's the right choice. Not that I don't trust the government, but I grew up with Nixon as president. I watched the Watergate hearings for fun. I'm naturally suspicious.
Weaver jotted a few notes to himself on his legal pad.
Another option would be to fight this through the normal chain of events. That's probably the safest path. In all likelihood, I can get you out of here within those 24 hours. They're going to have a hard time showing you as a terrorist.
Are those my only options?
Well, no. This case is extraordinary. Nothing since 9/11 has gained so much attention so rapidly. I could try to leverage that attention, that publicity, to get you released quicker. I don't mind a fight. That's what I get paid to do. But it's a question of what gives us the best chance of success. The key question is, what do you want out of this?
Nathaniel said, huh, to himself. What I'd like is to be able to go home to my house, my dog, and my friends. Maybe have a beer with John and talk about this. I'd like to go back to work at the hospital next week when my vacation is up. I'd like this to all blow over.
He looked at his attorney.
But I don't think that's likely. Do you?
I had to park 3 blocks away because everything closer was taken up by network news trucks and reporters.
Your friend John said they're already parked up and down the road you live on, staking out your house.
He had to fight his way through them to pick up your dog.
Weaver's smartphone chimed an alert. He thumbed it open, then read for a moment.
That's from my assistant. He says we're being swamped with interview requests, both for me and for you. I don't see any way that this will blow over soon.
Chapter 31. There was a sharp rap on the door. Then an Oregon State trooper, tall and intimidating, stuck his head in and motioned Thomas Weaver over. Thomas stood and walked quickly to him. They put their heads together in a whispered conference. Eventually Thomas nodded and returned to the table.
"Well, that's interesting," Weaver said, pitching his voice low and confidential. "There's someone that wants to meet with you, and I think it will be beneficial to our cause."
"By all means," Nathaniel said with a sweep of his hand and a smile. "I don't have any illusions that I'm running the show around here anyway."
Nathaniel and Thomas sat looking at each other, Thomas drumming his fingers for a minute. Finally, Thomas said,
"Hey, do you want me to see if they've got any coffee on?"
"God, no,"
Nathaniel said, just as the door opened, and Edward Buchan, the governor of the great state of Oregon, walked in, accompanied by the same state trooper and a young man with an iPad and a worried expression. Governor Buchan looked the part of a 21st century governor. He was tanned, but not too tanned, with dark hair graying at the temples, and fashionable, but not too fashionable, glasses. He strode across the room to Nathaniel, hand extended. Nathaniel, sitting with his legs crossed, was caught off guard at the presence of the governor. He did his best to untangle himself and accept the governor's handshake.
"Mr. Moon, I recognize you from the extraordinary video I saw earlier, and the pictures they've been broadcasting ever since."
Governor Buchan leaned forward slightly and peered deeply into Nathaniel's eyes, a long-held habit that had caused many a government employee to wilt.
"Truly extraordinary," he said as if to himself.
He gestured at the chair beside Nathaniel.
"May I?"
"It's tempting to say it's your state, you can sit wherever you want, but this is probably not the moment."
"Of course." "I'll get right to it then. Mr. Moon, you did a tremendous service for everyone today, but especially for me. I was in Eastern Oregon, doing an inspection of an area that had been ravaged by wildfires when this whole ordeal started. I did my best to get here to resolve this in a timely manner, but before I could, it seems you handled it on your own. And now I owe you a particular debt of gratitude. You see, my granddaughter, Marla, attends that school.
She's in Mrs. Adams' fourth grade class. If that madman had carried out his plans, she would almost certainly be dead tonight. The governor shook his head, and Nathaniel saw tears in his eyes. This guy's either an incredible actor or a sincere and real human being. I'll go with the latter. But what do you say to that?
I don't know how I could have gone on if that had happened. And I know I share that with hundreds of other parents and grandparents. Now, I've heard this nonsense about the whole thing being a setup and all that. But the people who would say that weren't there from the beginning, were they? They didn't face the impossible situation. You did. Now, I'm sure that by morning, the crazies and uninformed will be spreading rumors and far-fetched conspiracy theories. But those are the fringe elements. Nothing to be done about them. They will always be there.
Buckin slapped his hand down on the table. Enough of that. I came here for two reasons. First, to tell you thank you. So from my wife and I, and our son and daughter-in-law, thank you from the bottom of our hearts for the incomparable gift you gave us. The second reason is, I want to know if there's anything I can do for you.
Thomas Weaver raised his hand to Nathaniel and spoke.
Governor, I'm Thomas Weaver. I'm Mr. Moon's attorney. At the moment, we're sitting in a police station, and we've been given every reason to believe that we're not allowed to leave. And yet that is exactly what Mr. Moon would like to do. Is there anything you can do to help us with that?
Buckin turned to the serious young man, whom he had not introduced.
David?
1 minute, sir,
David said, and hurried from the room. Buckin returned his attention to Thomas.
The last I heard, the feds haven't passed on any instructions yet.
He glanced at his watch.
Of course, that's because the whole incident is only a few hours old. I'm sure interference from Washington is coming. I'm just as sure they're scrambling trying to figure out what to do with you. However, until I hear differently, it's in the hands of the local authorities and the state of Oregon. Please, no, anything I can do, I will.
The governor stood, shook hands with both Nathaniel and Thomas, and exited the room with the trooper in tow. Thomas looked at Nathaniel and raised his eyebrows as if to say, "Well, how about that?" Minutes passed, and Nathaniel had come to believe he was destined to spend the night in the care of the FBI or the Middle Falls Police, when the door opened and Special Agent Johnson entered.
"You've got friends in high places, Mr. Moon."
"Only very recently. Until today, I was only a VIP at the Quickie Mart, where I got every 10th cup of coffee free."
"You're moving up in the world, then. The governor has spoken to the Middle Falls police chief, and me, and asked as a favor to him, if we would facilitate your release sooner rather than later. Since I don't have any reason to believe you actually did anything wrong, and since I haven't received any specific orders from Washington, I am going along with that."
"Great," Nathaniel said, standing up quickly. "Let's go."
"If I were you, I'd make some sort of an arrangement. There's something close to 200 reporters and cameramen waiting at the front of the station, and they'd all like a piece of you. If they see you leave here, you're going to have a lot of company tagging along. But it's up to you. You're free to go."
Chapter 32. Half an hour later, Thomas Weaver emerged from the front of the police station into the glare of Klieg lights and camera flashes. He led a small entourage of people, including John West, Violet Moon, Ben Jenkins, another attorney in Thomas's office, and in the middle, a tall, thin man with a Middle Falls High School hoodie covering his head. The group was bombarded with questions.
"How did you do it, Nathaniel? Can you walk on water, too? Do another miracle for us."
That last wasn't a question, but it was heard repeatedly. No one in the group answered, but piled into Thomas's white Cadillac Escalade. The Escalade pulled away quickly and drove off into the night in the direction of I-5. As Special Agent Johnson had predicted, a number of reporters piled into their own vehicles and gave chase. The rest of the group stayed behind and began to pack up their equipment. After another 45 minutes had passed, everyone except for a skeleton crew of reporters and camera people who were waiting for further instructions had left. Initially, reporters had staked out the back door of the station as well, but when no one had emerged,
it appeared they too had packed up and headed elsewhere. Nathaniel Moon slipped out the back door and took a few steps toward a late model Toyota that had been left for him. He had only taken a few steps when he heard, "Hello, Nathaniel," from a voice deep in the shadows. Nathaniel cocked his head in the direction of the voice, then peered into the darkness. "Jeff? Is that you?"
"In the flesh."
Jeff Hudson, a reporter for the local Middle Falls Chronicle, stepped forward.
"Sorry, didn't mean to startle you."
"It's okay. You didn't. I knew someone had to be waiting out here. Glad it's you, instead of someone I don't know."
"Crazy day, huh?"
"You could say so."
"Have you always been able to do stuff like that? I mean, we went to school together, and I always knew you and John kind of hung by yourselves mostly, but..."
"But I didn't walk across the swimming pool, right?"
Jeff laughed, but said, "Yeah, exactly."
"I didn't wake up this morning knowing I could swallow a bomb. No. I didn't know I could do it until I had to do it. A lot of things in life are like that, right?"
"Sure. You hear about moms who lift a car off their kid, but I don't care how much stress I was under. If I stood that close to a bomb, they'd be picking up pieces of me and Eugene." Nathaniel just nodded, but didn't answer. "Don't suppose you want to sit down with me for an interview back at the office?"
"You suppose correctly. What I'd like to do is be able to go home and see my dog and play some music. But I'm not sure that's in the cards for a while."
"They've definitely got your place staked out. If I was wanting a little privacy, I would head the other direction."
"Thanks, Jeff. Much appreciated." Nathaniel climbed into the car, turned the key, and drove away. As he did, Jeff Hudson used his phone to take a picture of the back of the car, with a clear shot of the license plates. He sent a text to a national reporter who had promised him $500 for good information, and attached the photo. The text read, "This is what he's really driving. Send the money to me at the address I gave you." Nathaniel drove along the back streets of Middle Falls, streets he had walked, bicycled, and roller skated for more than 30 years. He pulled into the house of a friend of a friend of a friend, who was waiting for him on the front porch. When Nathaniel turned into the driveway, the man stepped off the porch. When Nathaniel emerged from the Toyota, he tossed him a new set of keys and nodded to a 10-year-old Ford Focus. It was blue and was about as anonymous a vehicle as Nathaniel could have asked for.
"Thank you,"
Nathaniel said with a wave. The man waved back and retreated inside his house. The lengths a man has to go to in order to maintain a little privacy. Thomas Weaver had orchestrated the whole escape for him. The person impersonating Nathaniel leaving the police station was Thomas's brother, Zach, who was older but had a similar build. It was also Thomas's idea to swap cars, certain that at least one person would see him leaving the station and record the license plates. Nathaniel turned the key and slipped the Focus into drive, then drove the streets of Middle Falls for 10 minutes, backtracking, checking for a vehicle that might be following him, but he didn't see anything. Nathaniel reached into his jacket pocket, pulled the small phone Thomas had given him out, and dropped it on the seat. Thomas had called it a burner phone. For the moment, it would be the only way anyone could get in touch with him. He worked the back roads until he came to the entrance ramp to I-5 and got on heading south. The decoy group was almost an hour ahead of him, and they had pulled off at a prearranged truck stop just south of Albany. By the time Nathaniel arrived at the same truck stop, the earlier group had gone in, ordered and eaten, and departed, leaving one member behind, Violet Moon. She was standing at the door, anxiously looking for him when Nathaniel drove in. She didn't wait for him to stop. She was out the door while he was still slowing down. She gestured to him to stay in the car, as she knew there were security cameras recording everything. She jumped into the passenger side and said, "Oh, Nathaniel, I am so sorry. Why do I feel like this is all my fault?"
"Because you like to take on guilt that isn't yours. Let's drive, and we can talk on the way. Where does the A-team have me heading now?"
Thomas said he didn't want to know where we were going. He was happy to play a part in getting you out of there. We're on our own again, just like we were all those years ago when we left Tubal. Life is a series of circles, isn't it? Let's just drive for a while, then, and enjoy our freedom. Chapter 33 Cyrus Creech laid in a twin bed in his cramped bedroom. A TV tray sat beside the bed, loaded with different pill bottles. He looked out his window onto a muddy postage stamp backyard, and the back of his rear neighbor's house. A television played quietly at the foot of his bed. He was in his mid-70s, but looked much older. Where he had once been thin, he was now emaciated. He had the look of a man with not many sunrises left in his lifetime. Cyrus was no longer the wealthy man he had once been. Despite the best efforts he and Byron could put forth, Creech Company had fallen into a familiar death spiral. Decreasing revenues had caused them to cut back on both raw manufacturing materials and personnel, which led to more decreasing revenues and more cutbacks. After doing that dance for 5 years and with their noses barely above water, the Great Recession of 2008 finished them off. Byron had gone to work for another company just so he could feed his family, and Cyrus had retired with his scant personal savings to a small home in a family neighborhood on the outskirts of Little Rock that he had once used as a rental. It was his only remaining asset, and he survived only by using a reverse mortgage to siphon his equity away month by month. Cyrus had long since given up any hope of finding Nathaniel. He had stubbornly held on to his investigative team and continued writing checks to them even through the first round of cutbacks at the company. But even he now had to admit he had held on to that chase too long. Alice had left him a decade before, not because she was deserting the sinking financial ship, but because the older he got, the more dogmatic and pedantic he had become. Where once Cyrus had been a man of stalwart faith, it had continued to shrink and shrivel through the years until he had become bitter and judgmental. When Alice left him, she moved in with Byron, his wife, and their two children. The topper on Cyrus Creech's misery cake came in early 2017, when he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. A quick Google search had revealed his likely fate, and in the ensuing months, he had resigned himself to it. He was lying in bed, working on the project of thinking himself to death, when a strange scene on the television caught his eye. At first, he assumed it was a feed from the set of a movie, with the special effects already added in, because it showed a bomb exploding in the back of a truck while a man seemed to absorb the blast, then release it into the sky. The news program backed that portion of the tape up and played it back and forth several more times. The next video the news program showed had a close-up of the man's face. There are tremendous differences between the human face at age 4 and that same face at 39. Nonetheless, a name tumbled from Creech's cracked lips. Nathaniel. He knew it was him with the same certainty he knew he was dying. He raised his head up off the pillow and clawed among the medicine bottles, looking for the television remote. He grabbed it and turned the volume up. "I have a hunch this is all anyone in America is going to be talking about today," the newscaster said in voiceover. "That, of course, is Nathaniel Moon, who many are calling the Middle Falls Messiah. What exactly are we seeing here? Is it the kind of miraculous act that hasn't been seen since biblical times? Or is it all a giant hoax? Too soon to tell." The replay of the bombing disappeared, and the newscaster himself was smiling reassuredly at the camera. "Whatever it is, you know we'll be right here to bring you the latest. Speaking of that, let's take a look at our 5-day forecast with Jenny Miller. Jenny?" Creech switched the TV off and swung his skinny legs over the bed. He put his feet into his slippers and tottered toward the bathroom down the hall. Seeing Nathaniel,
His great white whale, after so many years of searching, had reinvigorated him. Yes, he was still dying, of course, but he felt more energy than he had in years. Cyrus didn't have a cell phone anymore, so he got the house phone out and began making calls. 15 minutes later, he was pleased to know that he still had enough room on his one remaining credit card to book a one-way ticket to Portland, Oregon, and to rent a car there. He went out into his cramped one-car garage, filled not with his automobile, but with the remaining souvenirs of his once successful life. Boxes of pictures of Creech posing with a string of governors and state senators. More boxes filled with awards. Crystal shapes that read, Businessman of the Year, 1992, and the like. Useless, most of it. But he knew what he wanted. He had been lying in bed envisioning exactly where it was that very morning. Cyrus stepped around several piles and went directly to a black case that sat alone on a shelf. He retrieved it and returned to his bedroom. He sat on the bed with a wheeze. He was energized, yes, but he was still a very sick man who hadn't walked more than 10 steps at a time in months. He unlatched the box and removed the Walther P99 9mm semi-automatic pistol. It wasn't shiny black, but instead was a deep, dangerous green. He stroked the gun lovingly. I had one job for you, but now I've got something new. Let's see if the miracle maker can truly heal himself. Chapter 34. After an hour's drive, Nathaniel and Violet saw a billboard advertising clean and cozy rooms at the Standing Fir Inn in Cottage Grove just off the next exit. Been a long day, Mom. Let's pull off and recharge a little. They took the exit, turned right, and drove half a mile away from the freeway before turning right down a tree-lined drive to a series of small cabins.
I'd say if someone finds us here, they deserve an interview, Nathaniel said.
She went inside the darkened office and rang a bell that undoubtedly woke up the proprietor, who appeared a few moments later and sleepily checked her in. If he recognized her last name, he gave no sign of it. At 3 a.m., he might not have recognized his own mother. 2 minutes later, they were in the room, which, as advertised, was both clean and cozy. Cedar-covered walls, the kind of generic paintings only found in inexpensive motels, and 2 relatively comfortable queen beds. Violet sat on one bed and said, I know you didn't have a choice. I don't know where we go from here, but I'm proud of you. If you had to reveal yourself, you chose the best way to do it. Arcadia is safe at home tonight, along with hundreds of other kids because of you. If there's a price to be paid for that, whatever it is, it's worth it. Nathaniel sat opposite Violet. He reached out and took her hands in his. From the time I was little, when I found out I could fix people, I knew this would come. I knew I would be faced with an impossible decision. When I was standing there today, and I looked into the eyes of that man, I knew it wasn't impossible at all, though. It was easy. I've spent too much of my life trying to hide this part of who I am. Now, I have no idea what's next. And that's okay, too. That's life, right? Violet nodded. Let's get some rest, and we'll come up with a plan in the morning, because I don't have one now. Nathaniel, who normally only slept 2 or 3 hours a night, lay down on the bed, closed his eyes, and didn't move for nearly 8 hours. The next morning, Nathaniel awoke to find Violet already up and out of the room. He took a shower, then was just facing the prospect of putting the same clothes back on, when Violet returned with 2 cups of coffee and a big shopping bag. Here, coffee. We're on the run again, but we can still be human beings. It's gotta be better than what they were pretending was coffee at the police station last night.
She smiled, then reached into the bag and threw Nathaniel a plastic bag with underwear, another with socks, a pair of jeans, and a powder blue t-shirt that read in large block letters, "Come at me, bro." "Here, you can change out of your towel."